You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Pankaj Mishra was born in North India in 1969 and now lives in London and India. His first book was Butter Chicken in Ludhiana, Travels in Small Town India, a travelogue which described the social and cultural changes in India in the new context of globalization. His novel, he's very eclectic, The Romantics, won the Los Angeles Times Art Seidenbaum Award for First Fiction. His other work includes An End to Suffering, The Buddha in the World, which mixes memoir, history, and philosophy while exploring the Buddha's relevance to contemporary times, and Temptations of the West, How to Be Modern in India, Pakistan, Tibet, and Beyond, which describes his travels through Kashmir, Bollywood, Afghanistan, Tibet, Nepal, and other parts of South and Central Asia. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and The Guardian and many other publications. You may have read his excellent recent profile in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about Imran Khan, once Pakistan's greatest sportsman and now its most popular politician since Benazir Bhutto. His new book, which he'll discuss tonight with Nicholas Goldberg, is called From the Ruins of Empire. It tells the story of a remarkable group of men from across the continent who both hated the West and recognized that an Asian Renaissance needed to be fueled in part by engagement with the enemy. The ideas they created now lie behind everything from the Chinese Communist Party to Al-Qaeda, from Indian nationalism to the Muslim Brotherhood. Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk writes, in his brilliant new book, Pankaj Mishra reverses the long gaze of the West upon the East, showing modern history as it has been felt by the majority of the world's population from Turkey to China. These are the amazing stories of the grandfathers of today's angry Asians. In conversation with Pankaj Mishra tonight, Nicholas Goldberg joined the Los Angeles Times in 2002 as editor of the op-ed page. He became deputy editor of the editorial pages in 2008, and a year later was named editor of the editorial pages. He's a former reporter and editor at Newsday, where he worked as Middle East bureau chief from 1995 to 1998, and in that position covered many major stories, including the peace process in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, presidential elections in Iran, arms monitoring in Iraq, famine in Sudan, and civil war in Algeria. Nick most recently interviewed Joseph Lilleveld for Aloud, exploring his biography of Gandhi, which was a wonderful evening. I know tonight will be as well. Please welcome Pankaj Mishra and Nicholas Goldberg. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for coming. Welcome. I'm very excited about talking to Pankaj after finishing his book. His book is really a sweeping book that talks about the rise of the West in Asia, the response of intellectuals. It's an intellectual history of sort of. Is that me or? Classy.
I wonder if the same will happen to me.
I certainly hope so. It's embarrassing if it just happens to me. Anyway, it's a sweeping look at sort of the rise of anti-colonialist thought and intellectual history of it, and it goes from Afghanistan and Iran all the way to Japan and China to Turkey And it covers everything from the 1800s straight through to the current day. So it's really broad, and there are a million questions to ask Pankaj, and you're going to get your chance when I'm done. But why don't you just tell us who you are? I mean, without giving us a CV, tell us where did you grow up and what brought you to this book?
That's the hardest question of all.
That's why I gave it to you first. Yeah.
I think, you know, growing up in India, which I did, I actually didn't leave India until I was 26 years old, I grew up with a particular kind of history, and which was almost entirely about the emergence of India as a nation state, its liberation from British rule, it coming into its own with the help of people like Gandhi and Nehru. It was a glorious history, one that I was certainly very proud of, like many other Indians. And as a writer, you know, you have to then start taking a critical view of the sort of wisdoms that have been received by you growing up as a child, the ideas that have been implanted to you at school. But the process of inquiry or questioning that led me to this book really did not begin until quite late in my writing life. When I published a book of fiction, I published a book of travel across India's small towns. It really began when I went to Kashmir, which many of you would know is a troubled region. It's a disputed territory, disputed by both India and Pakistan. And there was a bloody anti-Indian insurgency there, which broke out in 1989. And the year that I went was one of the worst years of the insurgency. And I began to realize that the ideas I'd grown up with about India as this glorious nation state, many of those were not true. The fact that here was a minority which was being suppressed quite brutally by the Indian state. So that really made me question a lot of the received wisdoms I'd grown up with about history, about India's place in the world, of course also about my place in the world. And that, I think, set off this process of, you know, questioning the history of India, the history of South Asia. That started traveling in Pakistan. I went to Afghanistan soon afterwards.
Did you go to Kashmir on the other side of the border?
I did. I did do that. And also started traveling in China, went to Tibet, and began to discover that, again, the stories we had told ourselves about Asia or about our respective countries in the last 150 years, they had left out a great deal. They had left out some of the figures that I describe or not given them enough attention. They had left out these cosmopolitan figures, this particular cosmopolitan moment in the history of Asia. So, I mean, in some sense, it's a sort of slightly complicated genesis this book has, you know, doing these travel essays, doing these reported pieces for the New York Review of Books, and expanding my ideas, expanding my imagination a bit, and then, you know, reading a lot, reading widely. And this book is almost entirely a product of reading extremely randomly and widely, where I would, you know, look at figures in different national contexts and read different national histories and encounter the same figures sometimes.
Which brings me to a question I wanted to ask as I read the book, which is, do you speak the languages of all of these people you wrote about?
No, well, this is the thing. I mean, I think a book like this can only really be written by an amateur writer. I very much believe in this British tradition, which is fantastic, where you allow a certain kind of amateur to attempt serious history books, you allow them to write serious nonfiction without them possessing the kind of skills that would be required of you in academia, for instance. You know, you'd be breaking so many academic protocols if, as a person specializing on Ottoman history, you suddenly started writing about the Qing Empire. I think, you know, you'd cause some crises, some mini crises at least.
So you read mostly in translation.
Exactly. Yeah. And I didn't, you know, feel the need to spend years and years learning these different languages and poring over these very, you know, important texts in the original languages, which a scholar doing this kind of stuff would have to do. But that means that, you know, books of comparative history or books of this sort don't get written when they do get written, they tend to be collaborative projects, a whole team of scholars working on particular areas, and then those books never reach a wider audience. And I wanted to reach a more general readership with a book describe how, you know, people in that part of Asia were united by this shared challenge, this shared dilemma of Western power, how to respond to it.
So tell us a little bit briefly about your three major protagonists, who they are, where they were situated. I mean, they sort of chronologically follow, they overlap a little bit, but they follow one another. So tell us just, you know, who they were and why you chose them.
Well, the most important one, and he starts he's the first of the many portraits in the book, is Jamaluddin Al-Afghani, who was born in Iran, but he passed himself off as a Sunni Muslim in the various countries he traveled through. I think partly because he wanted to play an active role in the politics of those countries, and, you know, announcing yourself as a Shiite Muslim would put him at a certain disadvantage, to put it mildly. So he was born in Iran, traveled to India for his education, and he was there at a very crucial moment in India's history, post-1857. The Indian mutiny had just been brutally suppressed by the British, and Al-Afghani witnessed the whole sort of destruction of a whole Muslim culture and civilization of North India. And he absorbed that particular lesson very, very deeply. This lesson, which was of a society being slowly overwhelmed by people from the West, who not only possessed superior firepower, but, you know, whose political models, whose economic models, were of the kind that would devastate any society, whichever society they entered. And India was a classic instance of that. You know, people, merchants coming in, wanting to be traders, and soon followed by soldiers, and very soon the British were ruling large parts of India, administering it, and very soon they were growing opium in India to transport to China and force it down Chinese throats. So that kind of power, which had really not been witnessed before, the kind of, you know, many imperialisms had existed previously to the modern European variety, but none of them had possessed that kind of power that industrial capitalism or the scientific revolution had given the British and other Europeans. So Al-Afghani saw that, absorbed those lessons, and then whenever he traveled, Egypt, Turkey, Iran, he applied those lessons. He told the people he was working with, and he set up magazines. He would publish books and hang out with some of the most important figures in these countries.
And like, he really traveled widely.
He traveled extremely widely.
From one country to another. And he was constantly getting thrown out of countries when the rulers realized that he wasn't the kind of guy they wanted to befriend.
He also traveled to Paris, spent time there. He was in London. He was in Moscow. Very much, you know, a sort of committed activist. We don't even know whether he was a devout Muslim. I mean, he was working with Jewish Arabs. He was working with Syrian Christians at one time. In India, he was speaking of Hindu-Muslim unity. But he was, one thing he was very clear on, that imperialism had to be resisted. And his means of resistance varied in different national contexts. You know, one time he would speak of pan-Islamism. Other places he'd speak of Hindu-Muslim unity. The other place he would speak of constitutional democracy. But he knew that this was a force unlike any that had appeared on this earth, and that it had to be resisted in a particular way, and that you had to strengthen yourself very quickly. All these societies, Turkish, Egyptian, Iranian, or they would be overwhelmed like the Indians had been. And so in this short life, born in late 1830s, died 1897, he was responsible for an actual participant in some of the major mass movements in Egypt and Iran, and in other places, closely affiliated with some of the leading thinkers, writers, and activists in these countries. So hugely important figure, but lost to us, because nationalist histories, or the particular histories of Egypt and Turkey, would talk about his role in their particular context. They would not talk about what he was up to in Turkey and Iran. And then I move on to Liang Cixiao, who was, you could call him you know, one of China's foremost modern intellectuals in a sense. He did, much later than the Indians and the Arabs, he did the work necessary for the creation of the Chinese public sphere, you know, setting up the first mass circulation magazines, magazines that were read by ordinary people, the general public, the one to set up, you know, a publishing enterprise, to publish history books, also involved in translation, and had a huge influence on a whole generation of Chinese writers, intellectuals, and leaders. Huge influence on the first generation of Chinese communists who read him when they were very, very young. And indeed, an inspiration and influence to people outside of China, like the Vietnamese nationalists. Liang was being read very, very closely by people living in Vietnam, the magazines being smuggled through the French customs. So, again, a hugely important figure.
I was interested that none of the guys you wrote about adopted Marxism. I mean, they were anti-imperialists. I would have expected that they would have, you know, been pulled to the left, but none of them were communists.
Well, someone like Liang was actually quite suspicious of socialism, and he remained generally, you know, suspicious of, you know, ideas imported from the West wholesale, which, of course, the generation after him did. I think partly because people like Liang or Aleph Ghani were still had their foot planted in the old world. They still belonged significantly to a sort of pre-modern China, or in Aleph Ghani's case, a pre-modern Iran. So they were less vulnerable to the appeal of these hardline ideologies that began to emerge in the first half of the 20th century in places like China or in places like Egypt and Iran.
One of the things that you keep coming back to, it's a recurring theme, is the pull of the previous culture. You know, this battle over whether society should modernize, whether they should emulate the West, whether they should, you know, give up religion in favor of science and economic reforms and constitutional democracy, or whether there was something great to be held on to about Islam or Confucianism, and if so, how to do that. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, I mean,
dichotomy?
I think there were people very much concerned with, for want of a better word, one of them described as sort of moral culture, that this whole civilization of the West, which was about, built around money-making, it was about commercial expansion. It was about, you know, finding new resources and territories across the world. That particular model was ill-suited. They had a sense that this model was ill-suited to these societies, which were largely agrarian, where the ideas of the good life involved a degree of restraint, a degree of harmony. It was not about competition. So they could sense that there was a conflict there between these older ideals of Confucianism or of Islam and these new ideals of very successful, very and aggressive capitalist societies of the West. So they were very concerned that if we surrendered, if people in the Muslim world or in China or indeed in India or surrendered or swallowed whole these Western ideologies, they would, the end result would be disaster for everyone concerned. And, you know, in many ways they were very prescient, particularly Tagore, Rabindranath Tagore, the Bengali poet, who had a very clear prophetic sense of how Asian countries could not really adopt these Western models without seriously damaging their own cultures and also putting future generations in danger of serious conflict. And he was particularly keenly insightful on a country like Japan, which was the first Asian country to modernize itself on the sort of on Western lines, and then try and become even an imperialist power along Western lines, and he became a bitter critic of that whole tendency within Asia.
And you're talking about how in the 20th century there were leader after leader came in and tried to establish secular societies. You know, Jinnah in Pakistan, the Shah of Iran, Nasser, all of these guys tried to, you know, they sort of brutally oppressed Islam.
Yes.
Turkey also, Ataturk, and to no avail, right? Yes. They've in each one of these countries, it's come back. What's the lesson of that?
I think when a lot of these people looked at the West and tried to figure out what is the secret of its power, one of the things they alighted upon was that, you know, they have modernized and at the same time they have secularized, and that religion has been moved out of the public sphere, and that it has no relation to politics, and that one reason why they become so powerful is that the role of the clergy has been diminished greatly, the role of religious figures has been diminished greatly, and that religion is also a sign of backwardness. I mean, someone like Atatürk believed that really strongly, and so when he became the leader of Turkey, he clamped down extremely brutally on sort of any source of any institution of religious authority in the country. But you know, I think in many ways these were extremely bad ideas, because when you look at the history of Europe itself, it's only a very small part of Europe that underwent this whole process of secularization. We haven't really undergone a complete process of secularization, even in the United States, let alone large parts of the Muslim world. So this notion that many of the Muslim despots you mentioned had, that we can simply drive Islam out of public life and force it back into private spaces, force it back into private lives, was doomed to failure. And we've seen that even in Turkey, which was supposedly the great model of secularism.
In Turkey, it was 80 years of secularization.
Absolutely. Hardline secularism,
top-down. You couldn't wear a headscarf.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's still a problem about that. But in the last 10, 15 years, we've seen a return to forms of political Islam. And it has, in some sense, become a model for many other countries which are trying to reconcile the role of the place of Islam in political life with modern political institutions like...
Which is really, in many ways, the same struggle they were having in 1850 when Al-Afghani...
Absolutely, absolutely. So we could have actually, you know, avoided that whole process of this very doomed process which created a lot of very strong enemies. I mean, the whole rise of Muslim Brotherhood, the fact that Muslim Brotherhood became so important was because Islam in public life was stamped out as brutally as it was, and Nasser persecuted so many of the figures of Muslim Brotherhood. Same thing happened in many other Muslim countries.
Why don't we take this moment for you to read the paragraphs we talked about where Liang goes to the United States.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the...
I think he was the only one of the three of them who went to the
U.S. He was the only one to travel to the United States. One of the things I became very interested in while writing this book was how did some of the most sensitive, intelligent, educated people in places like China or the Muslim world looked at... How did they look at the West? What did they make of it when they encountered it, either in Asia, in the coastal cities of China, or when they actually travel to places like London or Paris or indeed the United States. And the best example of that is Liang's visit to the United States. Just as the United States is coming into its own as a major power and has, you know, completed its internal expansion and is beginning to look for territories, markets elsewhere, and there's a lot of pressure on the on American politicians from the local business lobby to start looking elsewhere. But it's also a country of deep inequalities, of course. That's 1903 is the moment. And Liang's, I'm just going to read a short portion about Liang's observations. The United States he traveled to was a country of extreme inequality. 70%, Liang reported in scandalized tones, of the entire national wealth of America is in the hands of 200,000 rich people. The tenements in New York...
Familiar idea.
90% now. It's getting better all the time. The tenements in New York horrified him. Commenting on the death rates in them, he quoted the Tang Dynasty poet Du Fu. Crimson mansions reek of wine and meat, while on the road lie frozen bones. Rich and poor, but a foot apart, sorrows too hard to relate. The political corruption Liang saw exceeded anything described in Henry Adams's novel Democracy, published two decades previously. And Liang began to lose his faith in people's rights as a cure-all to autocracy as his indictment of American democracy grew. As he saw it, corporate interests, played an insidious role in American politics. Frequent elections made for policy short-sightedness and cheap populism. People entering democratic politics tended to be third-rate. Far too many American presidents had been mediocre and uninspiring. The best aspects of American democracy were to be found at the local level, the political institutions of states, towns, and counties, and these were too particular to America to be adapted to China's circumstances. Democracy itself was best built from the bottom up over a long period. It couldn't be imposed through revolution, as the fragility of democracy in France and Latin America had proved. And even in America, the liberal democratic state had been achieved with much coercion. And now, as America assumed its place in the world, it faced the danger of over-centralization. Also, imperialism was becoming more acceptable in America as its financial and industrial power grew. During Liang's tour of America, President Roosevelt told a crowd in San Francisco that, "Before I came to the Pacific slope, I was an expansionist, and after having been here, I failed to understand how any man can be anything but an expansionist." Liang was struck by Roosevelt's directness. What was his point, he worried, in talking about role and purpose when he said, "playing a great role on the world stage and carrying out our great purpose. I hope my countrymen will ponder this." In many ways, I mean, people like Liang were outlining a kind of anxiety about this dog-eat-dog world of international relations, you know, which they were encountering every time they looked up from China and saw this country being encircled by Japan, by Western imperialisms, and now in 1903 by the United States. So he was sort of extremely worried about particularly the business corporations of the United States, which he says are more powerful than anything Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan could have imagined, that these would soon cross the Pacific to prey upon a weak China. So that particular anxiety about China being encircled was something he passed on to, you know, several generations of Chinese leaders and activists who've all kind of grown up, and it's become, you know, a major part of the whole propaganda campaign in China over the last 40, 50 years.
You describe how in the beginning many people in Asia saw the West as benign and to be admired. They came in, they had this tremendous military power, and they seemed to have built, I think you call them, humane civilizations at home. And it only slowly began to sink in that, you know, that the colonial adventure was built on racism, it was built on mistreatment, it was built on, you know, extracting resources. And, you know, and the extraordinary story, which we all know, but I hadn't thought about in a long time, of the addicting of the, you know, some enormous percentage of the Chinese population to opium.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
One of the most impressive things in the book, I think, is your opening section where you talk about this victory of Japan in the Straits of Tsushima over the Russian Navy, and how that was felt all across. Can you talk about what the reverberations of that were?
Yeah, I think, I mean, 1905 is when this happens, you know, in the larger scheme of things. And of course, the Russo-Japanese War is talked about in, you know, most global histories, but it doesn't really have the centrality it ought to have, because it was a huge event for a range of Asian societies and figures like Ataturk, who was a young soldier in Damascus, Sun Yat-sen, who happened to be in London during the war, and then he was passing through Aden when he was congratulated by Arab workers for the victory, who thought that he was Japanese. Gandhi was a lawyer in South Africa who was very excited, the last person to be excited about a war, but there he was. Even Tagore, you know, a pacifist, he received the news and he led the school children in an impromptu victory parade around his school courtyard.
Because it represented what?
It represented this victory for the very first time of an Asian power over a white country. You know, Russia was identified as a European power. Obviously, a lot of people in Russia would think of themselves as partly an Asian power, at least. But in the eyes of people who'd been humiliated for a very long time in a world order dominated by a small minority of white men, this was a moment of great emotional release, that finally one of us, the non-white people has, you know, done it, gone ahead, modernized itself very fast, strengthened itself, suffered the same fate as most of us, you know, isolated country for a long time, which Japan was, and then bullied out of its isolation by Western powers, and then finally, you know, just within half a century, it modernized itself and became strong enough to beat the West at its own game. And that was the message that, you know, this particular victory conveyed to all these Asians. And, you know, it actually sparked off a series of constitutional revolutions. I mean, one of the lessons they absorbed from this victory, people in Iran, for instance, was that Japan won because it had a constitution. It could check the arbitrary power of its ruler because it had a process of consultation. It had a semblance of democracy, and we need to have the same. So the activists and thinkers and intellectuals of Iran forced through a constitutional revolution. Something similar also happened in Ottoman Turkey. So it really the long-term consequences this victory had. I mean, and Gandhi actually talked about that when he first responded to the victory, that this is going to have consequences that we can not even imagine at this point. It really, this event inaugurates the history of modern Asia in this sort of moment of intellectual and political awakening, which has been going on for some time, but this is the moment where a lot of people think we can also do this, that we can also regain dignity in this world dominated by a small minority of white men.
I had forgotten how many uprisings there really were through this period. You had the Boxer Rebellion, you had the Mahdi in Sudan, you had uprisings in Egypt, you had the Indian Mutiny. I mean, were they connected to one another? Did people follow the events in other parts of Asia and one led to another, or were they all spontaneous and individualistic?
The news, we still haven't begun to explore in the way these events, the news of these events, you know, how fast they carried across a broad swath of territory. The fact that the news of the Indian Mutiny, and mind you, the telegraph still wasn't available in large parts of the world in the late 1850s, but people in Egypt knew that the mutiny had been brutally suppressed by the British, and there was a small rebellion in Egypt in response to that. So this whole sort of, you know, these cliches about internationalization or globalization and the fact that we live in this, you know, interconnected world, the fact that even back in the 19th century, news of the Battle of Tsushima, the Boxer Rising, people were writing about that in India, following that very closely. People were following the Opium War in India.
How did that news travel in the late 19th century?
Very slowly, through ship. You know, somebody, there were newspapers, there were newspapers very early on in India in the 19th century. And so they would carry this news and people would write columns about this, about what victory of Britain over China means for us and for the larger sphere of Asia. So I think political awareness had been developing all through the 19th century. And then, of course, you know, Aluf Ghani, someone like Liang, he wrote at great length about the fate of different Asian countries. And he published various histories of various Asian countries simply to educate the Chinese public about, you know, what was happening in the neighborhood and what kind of political struggles they had to engage in order to, you know, strengthen themselves and become a dignified people.
So to what extent does this rage still exist? You quote Orhan Pamuk in the book saying, "The Western world is scarcely aware of this overwhelming feeling of humiliation that is experienced by most of the world's population." So why is it that so many years after the decolonization of the middle of the 20th century that this anger still is there, and is it still related to what went on in the 19th century?
I think something very important happened in the 19th century that a small number of people, a tiny minority of the world's population, took an almost unbeatable lead in developing a particular political model, economic model, with the help of the scientific and industrial revolutions, and then exporting it in different forms across the world. And even people who tried to resist them, and the people I describe in the book, whose successors then went on to create powerful nation states like China or Japan or India, they had to borrow from these particular Western models, had to modernize themselves, had to modernize their economies, start the whole process of urbanization, industrialization. And of course, we know the disasters and calamities suffered by so many countries in that process, whether in China during the Great Leap Forward or indeed in the Soviet Union was the first one to go through that whole trauma of industrialization. Indeed, that trauma also happened in Europe, large parts of Europe. But Europe had the entire whole world at its disposal back in the 19th century. You know, huge continents to conquer, native populations could be subdued fairly easily, access to territories, resources, pretty easy. But that option wasn't available to so many of these other societies that tried to catch up with the West and was also humiliated in this process of being conquered and subjugated. So humiliation has became a really important factor, and I think we've underestimated its importance in shaping historical behavior over the long term. How people humiliated, told that they were inferior, their societies were inferior, who then tried to catch up and then failed because their societies weren't really equipped to undertake the kind of conquest, to undertake the kind of modernization effort that the West had really been extremely good at because it had all the resources at its disposal. So what we're seeing in the 19th century, what we're seeing is the beginning of a great split between one part of the world, and that split still exists, where you have, you know, people in large parts of the world who live in semi-modern societies where the process of modernization remains incomplete. And there's no way you realize that those societies will ever resemble the societies of Europe and America, that those people will never come up to that level. So that sense of being set this impossible target, these impossible standards, and the fact that you can never reach them, and the fact that you suffer so much in the process, you go through despotism, you through revolution and counter-revolution, civil war, I think over time they sort of builds up this sense of, you know, being humiliated, of being left out, of being left behind. And that's what I think Orhan Pamuk is talking about, this whole, you know, process that was set into motion back in the 19th century.
One of the things that you really feel as you read the book is that it's extraordinary how much the discussions that were being had 150 years ago are exactly the same as the ones we're having today. I mean, you hear that in Liang talking about the United States, and you hear it in the discussions in the Middle East, discussions having to do with Islam. I mean, did you feel every moment as you were writing this, the analogies to
Absolutely.
To today?
No, it's extraordinary how we revisit so many of these debates all the time, sometimes without realizing that other people have talked about these issues in the past.
I mean,
Some of these issues were resolved early on, but we don't know anything about them, so we keep on reopening, you know, same old problems. But so many of the problems of the Middle East in particular, I mean, have their genesis in this period and in the early sort of 20th century, that the whole, you know, it's actually pretty well documented, the whole carve-up of the entire region, the way arbitrary nation-states were created, and so on. So it created a kind of insoluble problem in that part of the world. We're still seeing that. We're still living through that in Syria, and indeed, who knows what else will happen in that part of the world now.
At one point, that Al-Afghani is quoted in a quote that you say may be exaggerated, but he's quoted by the French ambassador in Iran as saying, "The blood of infidels must run in order that the number of Muslims should grow." I mean, it's very hard to hear that without thinking of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and fundamentalism today. Is that am I wrong to make that connection?
Well, I think Al-Afghani inaugurated a particular political tendency which saw the world of Islam or the Muslim world basically as something opposed to the West, and the West being opposed to it at the same time. So with these oppositions in place, you could generate from them any number of ideas and ideologies, you know, from pan-Arabism to pan-Islamism, also forms of political violence of the kind organizations like Al-Qaeda have engaged in. But he was very clear. I mean, he himself never advocated any political violence. I think the closest it came was to speculating about assassination. And in fact, one of his disciples assassinated the Shah of Iran in 1896, and it's not very clear whether he was he did so at Al Afghani's command, or whether Al Afghani had anything to do with it.
Al Afghani didn't denounce it, though, did he?
No. Yeah. He wanted the Shah to go. He hated the Shah, partly because of his various shady business deals with European businessmen. But I think the idea of killing civilians randomly and just killing a whole lot of people to score a political point, that would have been anathema to someone like Al Afghani. So in that sense, he's not the progenitor of someone like Osama bin Laden, but he certainly, the whole sort of set of political ideas that he brought into being through his travels, through his writings, you can trace this particular tendency back to that era.
And you do clearly trace the path from his thinking to the Islamic regime in Iran, yep, to Sayyid Qutb and the creation of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. I mean, it's unquestionable, it seems, yep, to me, that one leads to another, and yet you paint a relatively sympathetic portrait. Obviously, it's useful to us to understand the roots of why people feel humiliated, why people feel angry, why the West, why there's this deficit of trust that you've talked about. Does that mean we have to be sympathetic to these groups? That we have to be...
Well, not so much sympathetic to these groups. I think the question really is of, do we understand this very long, tormented, complicated history that binds the West to that part of the world? Have we explored it sufficiently? Have we understood where does this rage come from? Or is it enough to identify this rage with a particular religion, with a particular culture, and then forget about it and just say, well, these people are temperamentally, you know, prone to behave like this or to respond in particular ways? I think it's obviously harder to examine this complicated history or to look at a figure like Al Afghani, to look at the late 19th century, to examine, scrutinize the political movements, the first political movement in Egypt, for instance, 1882, what did that consist of? It's so much easier to lapse into culturalist or pseudo-psychological explanations about Muslim rage and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think this history really is important in understanding what happened in these societies and why people there behave the way they do, which is not to condone extremism or the behavior of many extreme groups, but to see that, you know, where is all this coming from and why do some of these groups acquire popular backing? And, you know, one has to acknowledge that figures like Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah was at some point very popular amongst some Muslims in that region. That at some point Saddam Hussein was very popular. I mean, what did he signify when people looked up to a murderous figure like Saddam Hussein? It's too easy to say these people are irrational or they're all deluded. I think the simple explanation was that he represented some kind of a dignified figure, however briefly, who was standing up to the West at that particular moment. So there are, you know, that explanation is enough to understand, not to condone Saddam Hussein's behavior, but to see how people like that do acquire, you know, quite a bit of following.
Now you clearly see a parallel between the sort of the meddling and the use of power that the United States, you know, engages in today in the Middle East, and the imperialism that the European powers used in the 19th century. Yet if you ask an American today, you know, what's the American role in the Middle East, they'd say, oh no, you know, we knocked Saddam Hussein out of power because he was, you know, killing his own citizens, and we oppose Assad because he's, you know, torturing children, and we oppose the Iranians because they want to develop a nuclear weapon and blow up all their neighbors. You know, are we deluding ourselves about our purposes and our role in that part of the world?
But I think all of those things are also true to a certain extent. But I think that particular truth has to be complicated by other facts. The fact that the United States supported Saddam Hussein for a long time when he was fighting his awful war with Iran, when he was assaulting Iran with chemical weapons, a war that entrenched Iran's hardliners, who were still, you know, relatively insecure before Saddam Hussein started his war, and then the 8-year war, they became more and more powerful and soon were running the country. And soon the people who were empowered at that time, someone like Ahmadinejad, comes out of that period. So I think what is also required is a deeper, I suppose, not just a deeper understanding, but a possession of the right facts about that part of the world, how Western imperial powers, starting with the British and the French, and in the recent era, the United States has used these proxy regimes and proxy despots to advance its own interests and has not actually prioritized morality in international relations on most occasions. Sometimes it has, but on most occasions, they have chosen to play the game of realpolitik.
So in your, I'm just going to ask you a couple more questions because I have a million more, but we're running out of time if anyone else is going to get to ask any. But in an op-ed piece that you wrote in the New York Times last week, you described the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as bloody and wasteful, and you said it's time for a strategic American retreat from the Middle East. So what does that mean exactly? Is the U.S. to have no role in the Middle East? If Assad begins to, you know, kill more and more of his civilians, do we have no role there? Should we not be engaged in any way in stopping Iran from developing nuclear weapons? Do we have to cede parts of the Middle East to China because they won't step back? Do we have to give up our role, which you may think is a cynical one or not, of searching for a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine problem? Should the U.S. just back away from all of it because we're tainted by an imperialist history?
Well, I think it would be absurd to ask or demand a complete withdrawal or argue for no role whatsoever for the United States. I mean, there are many levels of engagement. But I think the way in which the United States has engaged with the region, mostly working through proxy regimes or trying to influence particular regimes using different forms of leverage, financial assistance is one of them, and to make them do things that they don't want to do and that the people in that region don't want their rulers to do, that has to stop. I mean, I think, you know, my op-ed appeared a day after a very interesting interview with Egypt's new president, who made it very clear that now we are not going to simply, you know, stand up and do whatever we are told by you. Now we are accountable to the people, and the people want us to do different things. They have other priorities. They're not really interested in carrying out your instructions. He was very blunt about that. So I think that is the reality that one has to now reckon with, that people in that part of the world are going to shape their particular destinies. They now have the freedom to make their own mistakes, that they don't want this paternal figure hanging around telling them to do things for their own good. Often they turn out to be things that the Americans want to do for their own good. So I think that attitude has to change dramatically, because it's become very clear that the United States is extremely unpopular in large parts of the Arab world, and not just the Arab world, but also places like Afghanistan. And indeed, Pakistan, practically every day, you have these tragic instances of Afghan soldiers and policemen turning upon their Western patrons and sponsors and killing them. I mean, obviously, some of them are influenced by the Taliban, but there's also this, I think we underestimate the degree of hatred and distrust that has been built up over the last decade of relentless war, tens of thousands of people being killed, many more rendered turned refugees, not to mention, you know, people mutilated. I mean, in Iraq, whole religion has disappeared. Christianity was destroyed in the last 10 years, one of its ancient homes. So living in that particular part of the world, experiencing this trauma, how can we imagine them to keep loving the United States? It's an extraordinary expectation. It's completely irrational, almost childish, that they will feel any degree of affection towards... go on.
My last question is, what's the alternative? Is there a model in a country like Turkey for a country that can be both modern but can also embrace its own history, its own past, its own religion, and can also stand up to the West? Or, I mean, we also have an awful lot of bad examples in the Middle East of things gone wrong. What's your... You say it's inevitable. You say it's a watershed moment for the West in Asia, and that it's inevitable that the U.S. in particular will retreat to some degree. So what are the alternatives out there, and how do you see this coming to a happy ending?
It's very easy to see how, just as Turkey has become so assertive in its foreign policy and it's taking out a sort of regional leadership role for itself and building alliances there, local alliances there, the Egyptians are trying to do the same. Egypt, as we know, was the leader of the Arab world for a long time before that role was eclipsed during the Mubarak years when it turned into a client state of the US. And they are trying to regain that role for themselves and talking about bringing Syria, Iran, on the Syrian question, bringing countries like Iran and Egypt and Turkey and Saudi Arabia together. So I think these local initiatives, when we look at this region from the outside and say, what's the alternative? But we don't spot how there are these local actors who have their own ideas about how to resolve the situation in their own neighborhood. They don't really want outsiders to, you know, come and meddle. That's a very long and bad history of meddling by outsiders in that region. So these people who are now taking responsibility for their own neighborhood, not following orders of some Western power, they are the ones who are going to resolve that situation. You know, someone like Iran, it's their neighbors who will have to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions. If they do indeed have an ambition to build a nuclear bomb, there are many countries there which are also concerned about this. So they'll have to deal with this. I mean, I think Iran's nuclear program will not be stopped. It's very clear. They will go to any extremes. And you know, I say this coming from a country which also suffered a lot of sanctions for its nuclear program. But, you know, for better or for worse, the whole idea of a nuclear program was so tied up with the idea of Indian nationalism. Same in Pakistan. The Prime Minister vowed after the Indian nuclear test in 1974 that we're going to eat grass, but we're going to get our nuclear bomb. And they did it. You know, it's the same thing is going to happen in Iran. If they do want a nuclear bomb, it's still unclear whether they do. I mean, they might want to reach the capacity to build a nuclear bomb, but not go the extra, you know, five steps it takes to build the bomb. So I think it's impossible to, you know, just issue these orders and think these countries are just going to fall in line. And one reason why they've been so intransigent is that they're going to go ahead with it.
You do point to some potential, you know, crisis points. And one of the main ones you talk about is in India and China. You know, the rapid economic development leading to a society of haves and have-nots that really could backfire if it's not handled. Is that a big concern? I mean, are you fundamentally optimistic or pessimistic about the next 50 years?
Fundamentally pessimistic.
Good. Hey, that's rational.
It's a great selling point for this book. I think the problem, as you say, is not just the potential of conflict between nation states like India and China, which are now bringing their massive populations, you know, 2.6 billion people collectively, into this utopia that has been promised to them, which is of the middle class consumer lifestyle, which people in this part of the world have enjoyed for some decades now. And the legitimacy of those elites, whether unelected ones in China or elected ones in India, it rests on fulfilling, delivering on that promise. And that promise we know is not going to be fulfilled. The world doesn't have, just speaking purely in environmental terms, the world doesn't have enough resources to sustain the lifestyles, the consumer-oriented lifestyles of a few hundred million Europeans and Americans. I mean, can we imagine this planet sustaining the lifestyles of 2.6 billion people? You know, two cars in every Chinese garage. They're having a problem right now with their roadways. I mean, they need to build more roadways to accommodate the number of cars that are being produced in China today. So it's a scenario which indicates not only conflicts between large, very hungry economies like India and China, which constantly need resources from elsewhere. And these are not resource-rich countries themselves, particularly in energy. So they're going around the world looking for reliable sources of energy. But also conflicts within these nation states, between the haves and have-nots. And we see that in India in the form of militant insurgencies in central India. There are various other struggles going on, which we don't hear of because Western press doesn't really cover it in much detail. It's actually more focused on China and the social incidents of social unrest in China. But there's a lot more social unrest in India at this point. And we know from the experience of the United States now very clearly, and of Europe, that globalization actually doesn't create a flat world. it deepens inequalities. It actually excludes a lot of people from the benefits of globalization, of free market economy. So why do we expect that India and China will also manage to bring all of its population to this particular level that they've been promised? So there's going to be a lot more inequality. In fact, there is a lot more inequality in these countries in the last 20 years. And there's a lot of frustration building up because, you know, once again, you've been promised this and it's not anywhere in sight. So that's, you know, that's the sort of larger pessimistic message of...
Good, because that's what we want to leave people this with. No one goes away happy.
That, you know, once you follow this particular model of growth, which in turn is predicated on, you know, abundance, natural abundance, and people in the 19th century weren't really thinking about, you know, a finite supply of resources or the environment so much. But now we have to think about these things, and we know that it's all finite and that we are already, you know, heading towards trouble, climate change, and just this last few months we were talking earlier, have been alarming signs of just how rapidly the sort of the climate, the way in which we experience freakish weather now. I'll stop here, but, you know, I've drawn enough of a...
Good. Every answer you give, I have 10 more questions, but I'm going to stop. We'd like to take questions from the audience, but we'd like to take questions, not speeches. Start with Sergio.
Hi. Do young Asian intellectuals like you see the current foreign policy of the United States as imperialistic? And if that is the case, would you agree with Nick and some other British historians that it would be a very benign imperialism?
I think it's much more complicated in the sense that America never had a formal empire, and it never believed in having a formal empire. There were some exceptions to that, but the kind of empires that the British and the French had, what it has had is a form of, it's a kind of informal empire enforced through sort of military treaties, military bases, and trade agreements, free trade agreements in particular, and in the last 20, 25 years, the set of economic policies imposed through the Washington Consensus and the IMF and the World Bank. So I think in that sense, it is a very, very different kind of empire than the ones we've seen previously. But I think I'm just speaking for myself, I find the American model, even when it's generalized across the world in a benign way, completely unsuitable for a largely agrarian society like India, because we can't really follow this, you know, whole sort of model of urbanization, of encouraging people to move to the big cities, leave or sell their farmlands and essentially become, you know, urban workers, office workers, factory workers. That this is not for us. This doesn't work for a country with 1.2 billion people. And again, we don't have the resources to, you know, to supply all the sort of accessories you need for, you know, these consumption-oriented lifestyles. So, I think in that sense, the models of American economy and culture and politics that have been diffused across the world, often backed by military firepower, are deeply unsuited to so many of these societies. But nevertheless, there has been a lot of coercion behind them, and it has also caused a lot of suffering, particularly in forms of, you know, we never talk about the suffering of inequality, but that's a very important experience. That's a very central experience in many societies. So in that sense, it's a peculiar imperialist power. It doesn't express its power through outright coercion or through the kinds of brutality we witnessed in the 19th century.
You talked about trying to understand the anger and the humiliation of some of these Asian countries and their pathos. But so, okay, we understand now. let's say 20 years from now, then what? I mean, what's the solution of for the world? Because we can't simply get away from globalization. I mean, we are here, the cat's out of the bag. What do we do?
I need another book to answer that question.
And we're sure you'll write one.
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I think my role as a writer is to describe, certain experiences, how people responded to particular situations, particular events. If I were to start also outlining policy or larger attitudes that people ought to have, I would move into the area occupied by that much dreaded word, pundits, where you start to, prescribe these large visions for, very, very internally very complicated societies and end up essentially, creating a lot of potential for disaster. But I'd say that understanding is the first step, really. I mean, and, how difficult, I think, is that first step for so many of us? It's easy to say, okay, that's it, we've understood that there was humiliation and so on. But it's not enough to just understand that, but to also understand the processes that led to that particular feeling of humiliation. And once you start doing that, then it's also possible to see, identify, particular processes, and to see whether we can prevent them or contain them in some form or other in the present moment. But I do think, the whole process of understanding these complex histories or complicated societies is not one to be underestimated, that it remains an important challenge for us.
I much look forward to reading your book, but prior to that...
No buts.
since you've spoken about it, I'm thinking these figures that you've drawn, evidently they have messages that you feel could be relevant to us today. And so from a certain point of view, what would you say somebody like Tagore represents both to India today in terms of maybe histories that have been lost, as you said, and to the world as you see it?
It was some of you might know that Tagore is the author of the National Anthem of India, indeed also of Bangladesh. And he's the most unlikely author of a national anthem because he was a bitter critic of the nation state and of nationalism in general, and spent a large part of his life traveling and giving speeches, writing lectures, almost indoctrinating people against the evils of nationalism. But I think it goes deeper than that, because what he's identified, what he diagnosed nationalism as, it's a brilliant phrase he used, which is organized selfishness, where he saw how societies galvanize their citizens, mobilize their citizens in this larger international quest for resources and territories, and that how that creates conflicts. And indeed, he lived long enough to witness the destructiveness of the First World War caused by competing nationalisms, of course. So I think that particular diagnosis of what happens when human beings collectively and individually lend themselves to these national projects, in many ways, the tragic history of the 20th century is really the history of people voluntarily submitting to these larger notions. The First World War, when it erupted, most people went gladly to fight. They were delighted by this idea of taking on these countries, these people from other countries. This whole notion of patriotism, of nationalism, and the idea that we don't actually belong to a common humanity, that we don't belong to this particular planet and we're not responsible for it. I mean, the environmental crisis has refocused our minds on just how interdependent the world is. And Tagore was talking about this very early on. So there are many, many such messages to be, I was going to say excavated, but actually not. That's not the correct word. They're all there in the writings. which we can still learn from, you know.
A couple of things, particularly on nationalism. Don't you think that the shame of humiliation can actually result in nationalism?
Absolutely.
So I'd like your comment on that. Colonialism, should I see irony in the fact that a North Indian now spends a fair amount of his time with the colonial masters in the UK? And I'm wondering if you think that the ideas of Russia and China now, as they seem to take an isolationist view related to the world community being involved in a place like Syria, is that an enlightened view to be isolationist and to let them battle it out locally and just stay away? Is it an enlightened view?
I don't know whether it's an enlightened or whether one could even pose a choice in those terms, these highly charged ways in which it has been posed, in the way you've posed it. Because with countries like China, leaving aside the morality of this particular obstructionism of China and Russia at the United Nations, one thing that several generations of Chinese leaders have grown up with this idea of national sovereignty and not interfering in other countries' affairs. They've occasionally violated that, of course, when they invaded Vietnam in 1979, but that idea has become, you know, almost sacrosanct, that we are not going to interfere in the affairs of other countries, because it's very likely then someone else would try and do the same to us. They're quite vulnerable on that score, particularly in Tibet. So I think there is that, and less so with Russia. I think Russia is much more cynical about the whole Syrian situation. But the Chinese are very, I think, determined about this. And my friend Jeff Wasserstrom, who's here in the audience, probably would confirm that particular obsession with sovereignty and non-interference in other countries' affairs. I think the notion of nationalism as a response to colonialism, I mean, that's really what the book describes, is the consolidation of sort of national identities as a response to humiliations inflicted by colonial powers. But the tragic side of that is that a country like Japan, in order to avenge these humiliations inflicted upon it by the West, turns into a mirror image of Western colonialism. So it turns into a nation state, but it also turns into an imperialist power within Asia, causes a lot of suffering across Asia, across China. And that is the tragic arc of history that this book also seeks to describe, how so many people, in order to regain dignity in the eyes of the West, ended up committing atrocities and sometimes on their own people in the cause of higher nationalism, in the cause of national unity. We still see that going on around the world. And that, you know, this is the particular trap of modern history, that in order to resist this overwhelming power, you had to adopt some of these horrible methods that other people had used against you.
excuse me. You've been talking about the West versus Asia, and I would say the United States particularly has kind of a lobotomy on history in general. Most of us don't realize we waterboarded people in 1903, but does Asia, Pakistan, India, do you feel they have a greater recognition or sense of history, in the sense that if we do A, the Sunnis and the Shias are going to start killing each other because they did it 100 years ago? Are they aware of those same types of roads that America goes down quite frequently?
I think there's a particular kind of history that is extremely well known in places like India or Pakistan, for that matter, which is a history of Western presence in that part of the world and the resistance to it by Indian leaders and the anti-colonial movement. So that history they are extremely aware of. But these, you know, other larger histories of sectarian violence, of communal coexistence, indeed both the violence and the coexistence, those are unfortunately relatively unknown, because they don't form part of this particular trajectory of the nation state, which is what we are told all the time. But we're not really taught about, say, the cosmopolitanism of Kashmir, for instance. So, you know, what has happened there in the last 20 years, I think we in India fail to appreciate the tragedy, the utter disaster of, you know, a cosmopolitan culture being crushed so cruelly, and the fact that, you know, here was a syncretic culture where Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism had come together. And because of this ham-handed attempt to keep Kashmir part of India, so many of the people there were forced into hardline positions, forced into embracing a militant form of Islam imported from Pakistan, in some cases imported from Afghanistan. So I think so many of us are unaware of the forms of Islam, the forms of, you know, cosmopolitan cultures that existed in those places there.
I'm wondering if your book describes the circumstances for women in these societies, and if you know of any particularly oppressed groups that you have maybe a more positive outlook on. Thanks.
Well, the people who entered public spaces from these societies in China and Egypt or Turkey almost invariably tended to be men. And they also tended to be from, you know, the respective elites in their societies. I mean, someone like Liang didn't come from a sort of major elite family, but, you know, family that had been, that had belonged to a certain tradition, and Confucian tradition. And same with Aluf Ghani. He didn't come from a very distinguished family, but still at the same time, he obviously had the means to go and study in India in the 1850s. But one thing they were actually concerned with was the question of women's education and the general improvement of the sort of conditions of women. But I think, having said that, I must say that a large part of this concern, and Aluf Ghani, in fact, gave a famous speech about the importance of women's education, making women productive members of Egyptian society. But the reason why he said that, and the reason why a lot of these people focused on that issue, was they saw women as becoming members of this national society, which could then, you know, become strong enough to match the West. So women's education was not seen as an end in itself. It was seen as a means to a higher end of, you know, self-strengthening. So even though you might say that they had very enlightened views on some of these questions, women's education was still secondary. The primary aim was national self-strengthening. So it was in that context that they spoke about, you know, how we need to get women out of their homes and get them out of domestic servitude and get them into schools and colleges and, you know, get them basically also into political movements. You know, women in Egypt participated in political movements in large numbers in the early part of the 20th century. And there were any number of people who were encouraging them to do that, any number of secular-minded, enlightened Egyptian intellectuals and leaders. But it was all with this larger aim of national self-strengthening in mind.
Although, if I'm remembering correctly from the book, you do say that one of the positive things that the West brought to Asia was that it encouraged regimes there to look out for ethnic minorities, political minorities. Absolutely. I mean, probably Christians more than anyone else, but yeah. But others as well.
Yeah.
Last question.
I just want to ask that in the last 10 years, from what I see in Afghanistan, Iraq, it's going backwards for women. They suddenly can't go out to jobs, they have to cover themselves, and their life has gone, you know, totally backwards. So what do you think is going to happen next if America pulls out and they're all left to their own?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think America pulling out, how much worse can it get?
Because
I mean, I think at some point the people in these societies have to take responsibility And as long as the United States is there, as long as there's a foreign presence, they can always blame them and blame them for everything that's going wrong in their particular societies. So I think, you know, almost the sort of prerequisite for anything happening in these societies, any kind of political movement or any kind of social reform, is that the occupier leaves. The foreign occupier has to go before anything, these societies acquire any semblance of, you know, an autonomous life, a life in which political movements, groups can participate, and then they'll have to sort it out. It might not be pretty for a long time, particularly in places like Afghanistan, with so many guns in private hands and so many enmities and animosities dating back from this period when the Americans were supporting one group against the other and Karzai against this person, and Karzai himself was playing various games. So it will definitely not be pretty, but I don't think the solution is for outsiders to come in and try and dictate the course of events there. At some point, the sort of foreigners will have to withdraw and give the society some space. I mean, you think of a place like Afghanistan, for such a long time, it's not just the American intervention in the last decade or so. There was a short gap, but from 1978 onwards, it was the Soviet Union that was trying to shape events in that country. Extremely brutally, much, much more brutally than anything that has happened in the last decade or so. And that was such a calamity, you know, how many people were killed at that time. And in this doomed effort at modernization, we forget about this, how the communists, the Soviet communists, tried to modernize this agrarian, essentially sort of nomadic agrarian society. And with such brutality, you know, mullahs being shot on sight, girls forced into schools, their fathers being beaten publicly, the kind of stories that emerged from that period. So I think we need to give them enough space in which to move towards these things like education and political reform. As long as the foreigners are there, whether it's the Soviets or the Americans, it's not going to happen.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.